Well, good afternoon. Hello, everyone, and welcome to the 27th MBT Fireside Chat. Today, it is September 11th, 2016, and a good time to remember those who lost their lives in those terrible events of 15 years ago today. I noticed that last time I sat in this chair was a couple of months ago, and I welcomed everyone to the 25th Fireside Chat for July of 2017. So sorry for any confusion that would have caused, and I promise no time travelling on this occasion. I guess I had 2017 on my mind because of Tom's upcoming Cultural Connection tour, so sorry about that for any confusion. Right, on with the chat. Lots of questions as normal. Hi, Tom.
Hi, Keith.
Actually, talking of the events of 15 years ago, we are going to dive straight in at the deep end with a question from Gary G, the one and only Minnesotan. Now, I wasn't sure whether we should go here today, but, you know, here goes. He writes, after viewing some of Tom's latest YouTube videos, I have another question for him. I'd like a little bit of further clarification on his viewpoint on conspiracy theories, specifically 9/11 and being an inside job. According to information in my data stream, garnered from material found on various websites and my own personal observations of the rule set governing how virtual solid objects respond when they collide in PMR, it is hard for me not to deduce that the destruction of the Twin Towers, and especially World Trade Center 7, which was in total freefall for over 2 seconds as it imploded symmetrically on its own footprint, could have been anything other than controlled demolitions due to expertly pre-planted explosives. Now, while I admit that the idea that powerful factions within the US government could murder thousands of innocent citizens with complete impunity to facilitate an aggressively foreign policy frightens me a great deal, I don't understand how seemingly objective facts, such as the positive identification of high-tech explosives in the debris by independent teams of scientists, could be considered as simply an ongoing subjective manifestation of my or society's fears. Surely, doesn't the historical database contain a thread of what actually happened, even if the truth isn't widely known and is being actively suppressed? Now, I certainly appreciate the wisdom that, when confronting what one perceives as enormous injustice, one needs to become the change you wish to see in the world by primarily striving to lower one's own entropy. But surely, does that mean then what one should abandon attempts to warn fellow Americans that they've been duped with a big lie by sinister high-ranking criminals who remain at large and may very well attack again if not apprehended? Or is this simply my ego trying to be Mr. Smarty Pants? You know, there's one to start with, Tom. What do you say?
Well, you picked a good one to start with. I've answered this question before, matter of fact, in a fireside chat. A very similar question was asked I don't know how long ago, kind of lose track of that, but in the last year, I think, that the same question was asked, so I can kind of refer people to back to that chat. I don't know, maybe somebody here will know what that day was that we had that chat, but anyway, there's a couple of things to consider here, and that is that, one, in our culture in particular, but probably in almost all cultures in general, reality is defined by what people believe more than it's defined by what actually happened. Okay, history is defined by what people believe more than it's defined by what actually happened. We ignore the things we're uncomfortable with. We make up things that we're more comfortable with, and then we move forward from there. It's just the way it's just the way we are, partly because we are, third graders or, elementary school students, at least, in this consciousness evolution game. We're not very evolved. We deal with our fear daily, with our beliefs, and our reality is an example of those fears, egos, and beliefs. Okay. Now, sometimes it's obvious that the facts on the ground, as we perceive them, are, at odds with the beliefs of the way our reality is, and that happens in all sorts of fields, where we have facts on the ground, but we have beliefs that kind of override those facts. That's true in the quantum mechanics, where we have, facts on the ground of materialism isn't a viable worldview, because the double slit and other experiments show that it's reality just doesn't work that way. But beliefs, you know, continue to dominate the attitude of scientists anyway. And that's been now almost 100 years. That's like 90 years ago that we had information to the contrary, but we just keep on keeping on and pretend that Newton had the right idea, that this is a big machine. It's a bottoms-up materialistic thing made of particles. So that's just, you know, that's just another example. So the example you give, of course, of the World Trade Center, you know, there seem to be these facts on the ground. They conflict with what we want to believe, what feels comfortable for us, our levels of fear and so on. So they're just not dealt with, recognized. Nobody takes the trouble to pick them apart. You know, you would think that we have evidence in what seems to be factual information, and yet nobody seems to care. Nobody seems to really get serious about it. Where's the big investigation? Where's the, you know, where's the energy to dig into the truth of this matter? Well, the energy to dig into the truth of this matter is out on the fringe somewhere. It's a small bunch of people rather than the mainstream. The mainstream isn't interested in that truth. It doesn't play well with their sense of reality. It conflicts with their beliefs. So it's the same thing all over. You know, what you see happening in physics and what you see happening in our culture, it's all, you know, that happens everywhere. Those are just two examples. We could go on and name a dozen more examples where the exact same thing happens. So that's part of the frustration that this question asker feels. You know, well, what can we do about this? Well, you know, facts have been raised, issues have been raised, and we see what we as a culture and as a nation do with it. Primarily, we ignore it. We don't dig into it. We don't have the big, you know, examination. We say, well, that's odd, but, you know, we, you know, maybe that stuff that's uncomfortable for us just doesn't exist, and maybe it's not that way, and maybe these people don't know what they're talking about, and that makes us feel better. Physicists feel the same way about the double slit experiment. You see, you just don't pay attention to it. Maybe one day we'll find out, you know, that it is really just particles and we just don't know enough yet. And you just make up all the things you need to make up to make you feel better. So that's the culture, and that culture isn't likely to change. It represents the quality of our consciousness. So this idea of just, you know, what are we going to do to make this big breakthrough? And it's unlikely it's going to happen as a big breakthrough. It's going to happen little bits at a time. Eventually, we get to the point where the fears are such that we can deal with the information, and then things will begin to change. And then they'll change rapidly, and then it'll go right back to a present tense trends continue sort of mind, because that's the way we are as people. So that's kind of a bigger view of the situation and why the situation is like that. Now, the second thing to keep in mind is that in our time of, what do we call it, maybe, in the information world that we live in, information, there's so much of it, and anybody can put information out there, and anybody can claim to be almost anything, and we have conspiracies about all sorts of things, and how do you tell fact from fiction? How do you know that what you're seeing is, you know, what happened and not some, you know, doctored photograph or doctored movie or animated, you know, presentation? How do you know that the fact is a fact? How do you know that any fact is a fact? So you hear, I don't know, and particularly in this conspiracy world, you hear all sorts of things. Oh, there's a fact. Yes, we have absolute proof that, you know, the president of the United States had a meeting with six aliens just last week, and they decided that, you know, and we got this information from, you know, the insider who da 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 da, and they go on, and they'll present a whole list of facts that why that they know that that is a fact that that happened. Well, was that a fact? or somebody just have a good imagination, making it up, going to a lot of trouble to present it as a fact, and it's not really a fact at all. So that's a problem, you see. Here we are in the information age. We have tons and tons of information, but we have precious little that we can actually say are facts. Now, that leaves us in a position of having to use our, we have to use our intellects to look at the uncertainty in the information, and uncertainty exists in all information. Because we live in an information age, we live in the age of propaganda. And propaganda is just information that's designed to get people to feel and think in a certain way. And that's on all sides. Fear is the way we get people's attention. So in conspiracy theories, often whatever the conspiracy is about, there's fear involved in it. It's a scary thing. That's the nature of conspiracy theories. It's always about something that you should be afraid of, something that should frighten you. Something awful is going on behind the scenes, and that's what the conspiracy theory is all about. So fear is an attention getter. Evidence is uncheckable for the most part. If you look at that, we look at all the evidence that seems very credible, how much of that really is credible? So it gets us to this point of dealing gracefully with uncertainty, where you have to be open-minded but skeptical, and where you have to deal with reality the way it is, the way people are, the level of fear in the land, okay? The way fear is used in propaganda to manipulate opinion. So I'd say the way to look at this is is being skeptical, but yes, being open-minded. So you look at the evidence, and in your own mind, you decide, do you believe this evidence? That guy that got up and said, well, I'm a structural engineer. And I said, was he really a structural engineer? You see, you have no way of finding that out. It's too hard for you to research everything at that level of detail. And if he is a structural engineer, what are his politics? What are his beliefs? Where's his propaganda coming from? And we tend to all be propagandists in that sense. We all work to image. In general, our life is about our image, about how we look, how we present ourselves. Do other people find us credible? If not, then we can range to sound more credible, and it doesn't require us to be more credible. So when you look at truth versus image, or truth versus, the way things look, then our culture runs on the way things look, not on the way things are. It's just the nature of the place. So I would say that everybody needs to look at the evidence that they see, decide how credible that evidence is to them, be open-minded on all sides, and then live gracefully with the uncertainty that you're left with. And yes, education's good. So you can try to educate people, and there are the 9/11 truth commissions and things like that that trying to educate and move their points forward. But there's also the inertia in the culture that doesn't really want to go there. And this will just play out as it plays out. And there's not a whole lot that you can do to change it other than get on the bandwagon of education. But to make it a scary thing, to deal in terms of fear, it just makes the problem worse. Dealing in terms of education, that might be helpful. That may bring us to the point where we do decide to look at it, where the culture does have the ability to study the problem and come up with resolutions. We don't have that will to do that now. There's no will for that in our culture because these truths have been around now for, what'd you say, Keith, 15 years? There's nothing new. It's not like just last week or just last month all these inconsistencies were discovered. These inconsistencies have been talked about and filmed and shouted out for 15 years. Very close to it. Maybe 14 years. Maybe it took it a year before it got going. But, you know, it's been around a long time. So this is not new ground. It's not like suddenly, you know, we have a lot of new information. It's just there's a growing sentiment that we need to deal with the information we have and not just ignore it. But until that sentiment becomes wider in our culture, it's just going to be the way it is. So that's kind of my advice about it. Open-minded skepticism and live gracefully with uncertainty. Do what you can. If you want to put your shoulder to that wheel and help educate others and help raise the quality of the consciousness in our culture so that we can deal with issues, that we can say truth comes first, image comes later, that would be great. But that requires everybody in our culture growing up some. And that's not something that's likely to happen real quickly. And just shouting the truth in their face doesn't help. You see, when you're talking to believers, when you're talking to people with fear, they're irrational. Rational argument has no effect on an irrational fear and belief. And all belief and fear is irrational. So don't be frustrated that your rational argument is not having a very big effect, because what you're trying to change is fear-based and belief-based, and rational argument has no traction, has no ability to modify irrational fear and belief. So I'd say keep at it, just like I'm doing. I'm keeping at plugging on that thing with the quantum mechanics shows you that the reality is, can't be material. Well, I was probably, me and two other people thought that virtual reality was a good idea a decade ago. Now there's thousands of physicists who agree with me. So we're making progress, but that was a decade. And those experiments, like I say, are almost 100 years old, and it's perfectly clear that materialism, isn't a viable solution to how this reality works. So it's slow, but keep it up, and eventually change will happen, and eventually the truth will out, because the truth always rises to the surface eventually. But don't be so frustrated if it doesn't seem to go faster than you want, because in order for it to move, people have to grow up. And as you know, people growing up is a slow process.
You're right, Tom. And I know you had answered that question before, but I thought today it would be pertinent just to revisit it and let people refresh their memories as to what you said there. It's funny you mentioned about the experiments being that old, because I think it's time for some new experiments. Tom, how are you getting on with those?
I'm working on it. It's hard to find the time, you see, to do these experiments. Well, the experiments have all been written up. That's not the point. It's not that I'm trying to come up with the experiments. They're done. They have been done for months, for probably 6 months or more. Where the problem is getting the YouTube presentation done. And for me to do that, it takes a block of probably 4 or 5 days with nothing else going on. And that's just really hard for me to pull out. I'm having a hard time getting blocks of time that I can put this thing together and do what it is I have to do. So I'm working on it. I think we're getting close. I'm hoping that we're in the getting close to the end game there. But it's like sometimes the faster you run, the further you get behind. And it's been a very busy time. So my problem, of course, is email. I have so much email, so many questions, so many things that need to be done. I'm the single point of failure in the whole book business. Every book that is sold in the world in MBT has to come through me. You see, it's not like there's some big machine someplace that cranks that out, and all I have to do is overview it or something. Every book that goes out to the market, it's because I sent it to the market. I personally have to, send in orders to have books shipped and that kind of thing. And that business requires a lot of details that has to keep done. So I got that, and I got email, and I got a lot of other things that won't let me just go off for a week and do something else. Otherwise, I get so terribly behind that it becomes impossible to catch up with all the details. So that's where it is. I'm working on it, Keith, and I know you're probably sick and tired of hearing that. I've been telling Keith that I've been working on it now for probably 6 months, and it's just hard to get it all together. But soon we're gonna have that out. I'd really like to get it out before I do this thing at the end of October in L.A. You know, I'd like to have that behind us and out before I go there. So that's my goal, and if I can do it in the next couple of weeks, that would be wonderful.
Yeah, it is a busy time coming up, Tom. There's no doubt. For those of you watching this who are not aware, that Tom is mentioning Dagda's event, mbtla.com. Justin, you're involved with that. Thank you very much for all your help and hard work there. How is that going, Justin? Is that getting along nicely? Is things coming along?
Yeah, it's going along good. We still have a few more tickets to sell, so if people are interested, there's still some room. But it looks like everything's going ahead, so it should be a good event.
So let me mention MBTLA. That's LA, California. It's going to be in the Los Angeles area for all the listeners out there. If you can make it, it's going to be a real good. It's a two-day event. We're going to go over all of the basics as well as some more advanced things, and I think it'll be a lot of fun.
Yeah, the website is mbtla.com. So for anyone that's interested, you can always email us, keith@mbtevents.com, if you have any questions. It's not actually an MBT Events event, but we can put you in the right direction and help you with any questions you may have. Obviously, Tom, our next thing is our Cultural Connection Tour, which is coming around far too fast. That'll be here before you know it. And with reference to our upcoming Cultural Connection Tour, I do have an interesting question from an MBT reader up in Vancouver who has concerns whether she should actually choose to attend. And this is what she writes. Tom, as a professional engineer, I certainly have all the left brain baggage that you describe. Even though I've read all of your books, viewed every one of the videos, and regularly meditate, I have never reached point consciousness. Now, I'm concerned. I know, it's a fear I need to get rid of, that I would make the trip to one of your workshops and be surrounded by people who are remote viewing, healing, having much larger consciousness adventures than I could, when I cannot even get out of my mind, as Tom would say. I'm aware that this concern is likely impending the very thing that I want, and I know that's a belief, but that does not solve my problem. Maybe there are other people out there in my situation. We're not advanced enough to be able to participate. So is it possible that you could maybe offer some suggestions today or maybe elsewhere where people like me could go to? I'm sure that once I get a whiff of progress, something that becomes part of my experience, I will use this kernel to grow rapidly. So what would you say to that, Tom?
Well, one, there are a whole lot of people in that same boat. So you... the question asker is not alone there. There's a lot of people, and particularly the people who are very dominant left brain are in that boat. So that's, this question will then talk to a whole lot of people. The thing that you can do that will make the most difference is to just relax and let go of the trying to do is getting in the way. And you seem to know that because in the question, you do say that, yes, that's a belief. And yes, that's a fear. And yes, these things are probably getting in my way. And you are absolutely correct on all of those points. They are beliefs, they are fears. And that's what's getting in your way. Okay, how do you get around that? Some people get around that because they basically get frustrated to the point that they just say, the hell with it. I'm just gonna meditate. I'm not going to try to get the point conscious. I'm not going to try to do anything. I'm just going to do it. I've given up trying. Doesn't work. So I'm going to do it. And of course, that's when it happens, is when you've given up the trying, because now you're getting out of your way, basically. You're your own worst enemy in this case. So the idea is to stop trying to do. It's not a matter of doing. It's a matter of being. Just be. Just have the experience. You're just going to experience something. You don't know what it is. You're just going to experience it. You're going to meditate and just let go and see what happens. You're not trying to get to point consciousness. You're just relaxing. You're letting go of the world around you. You're letting go of the data stream that defines your physical reality, which means you're not paying attention to any of your sense data. And then just see what happens. You know, do it that way rather than trying to achieve a result. Try to just do the process and let whatever happens, happens, with the idea that if nothing happens, that's okay. It's good just to do the process. It's relaxing. You get some good meditation time out of it, and don't have a goal. Don't have a, you know, don't be driven to a result. It's that drive and that goal that gets in the way, because that's all your intellect. It's hard for you to just be when that intellect is out there in front trying to meet a goal. Do something. Not about doing anything. It's about being. So that would be my first advice, that you are in your way and you need to just kind of back off, relax a bit, and be more casual about it. And the problem with left-brainers is that they're used to solving problems with their intellect, and their whole worldview is that the way to solve a problem is to focus on it with your intellect. Do the right things, you know, the right prescription, go through the right motions. You know, am I doing the right technique? Is this right? They want to control the process, because that's what left-brainers do. They control the process. They control where they're going so they get to their goal. That's the way left-brains work. And instead of trying to control the process, you have to let go of control. Just be an experience. Another thing that you can do, a second thing that you can do, is to ask, in when you are in this meditation state, whether it's point consciousness or not, just get in a good meditation state. And even if you're just in a quiet state, maybe some people say, I can't even get into a good meditation state. Well, when you're just in a quiet, relaxed state, put out the intent that you would like to have the experience of point consciousness, that you'd like to have the experience of outer body, if you will. You'd like to have some of these experiences because it's important to your understanding to have the experience, that you think it's an important part of your growth and you're open for it, you'd like to do it. And if you could use any help that you could get, if you keep that intent going, the probability of you getting that help is much, much higher. So just keep that focus in your mind that, okay, larger consciousness system, I'm really trying to work with you here, but I need a little help. You know, I'm having trouble with these experiences. But then just be open to it. Tell your intellect to sit down and be quiet and just be and see what happens. Now, when you find that when you're meditating and you'd like to be in point consciousness, but thoughts keep coming by, you keep seeing things, you know, but it's all garbage. Well, that garbage may not be garbage. It may just be your intellect that defines it as garbage. So you're in this meditation state and you say, okay, I'd like to, you know, get such and such an information out of the database, and you're trying to do these things, and instead you get, dancing elephants in tutus or something out of an old Disney movie, and you say, oh, what trash, you know, stop it, mind, you know, settle down. Well, don't do that. If you get dancing elephants in tutus, go with that. Watch it more carefully. Zoom in on it. You know, dance along with them. Become a part of it. Question it. Why? You know, what is this about? Where does this lead? Anyway, involve, engage with it. Don't throw out the stuff that you think is trash. It may be trash, but it may not. So engage with it. And if it's trash, all you have done is wasted a few moments worth of your time. But if it's not, those dancing elephants will turn into something else that will turn into something else. And then bingo, there you are, you see, in some other reality frame. And it was all because you were being with whatever it is you see, whatever it is you feel. You were connecting, you're connecting yourself to it. You're letting it go. You're not trying to control it. This idea, well, that's garbage. That's you in control. You're now sorting. You're saying, well, this isn't good. This isn't what I'm expecting. I'm expecting something else. Well, exactly what are you expecting? And you'd say, well, I don't know. You know, an old man in a long white beard wearing a robe, you know, with a lot of light around his head, that would be good, you know, but that's just more garbage, you see. That's your expectation. So go with anything you see. If you see that old man with the light around his head, well, go for that too. Engage in everything. Become a part of it. When I say engage, I don't mean intellectually. Engage at the being level. Become a part of it. Go into it. Meld with it. Become one with it. That's what you do. And in the process of doing that, you'll find a lot of these things that you've blown off as being irrelevant and that they represent your failure are actually doorways to where you want to go. So again, it's the process of getting your intellect, getting that judging, controlling intellect to just sit down and be quiet and just be and see what happens. Be a scientist. Just experiment. You don't know what happens. You're not trying to make any particular thing happen. You're just going to experience it and be aware of whatever it is. And if nothing happens, that's okay too. Accept that as you've had a nice set of relaxation, you've had a good meditation, and that's good all by itself, if that's what you get. And when you can accept that is when more things besides that begins to happen. So that's my advice to that person. Just try to get out of the way and let it happen on its own.
Yeah, that's very good advice, Tom. And I think that's a good point is that, if anyone who comes to one of your workshops, one of your events, they don't have to have a knowledge. You know, if they have questions, not only you, but all the people that are there, they're in a place to answer people's questions just as well. So it really is open to anyone who is skeptical and open-minded and just wants to know, right?
Yes, the feeling that I'm failing at this and I just can't do it is a sure way to not be able to do it. You see, so again, it's your intent when you have that attitude that, well, I can't even get up to beginner status. You know, I can't even get started. And you find that is a problem and that frustrates you. Well, that frustration will keep you from getting there. So the point of this is not to trip around in other reality frames. The point of all of this is to grow up, and you can grow up and become love without ever getting to point consciousness or ever, you know, going out of body or getting data or anything else. So if you just focus on the growing up part, getting rid of the fear and getting rid of the ego, let the other part go, and it'll just happen naturally without you trying to make it happen. Focus on the growing up. Let that be your main thing and let the other stuff just happen as it does or not.
Right. Thanks, Tom. That is great advice. Okay. Next, we're going to go over to Lawrence. He has three linked questions about death, being deceased, or for you Monty Python fans out there, shuffling off this mortal coil. Lawrence, it's all yours.
All right. Thanks, Keith. Hey, Tom.
Lawrence.
Hey, how you doing? Nice to talk with you again.
Okay.
All right. I have a three-part question. It's sort of similar to the, I guess, some of the stuff that we already kind of talked about previously. I just asking it with just a little different approach to it. So anyway, my question was, according to Tom, after we leave PMR, the life we just lived is vivid. And after a while, our memories start to fade away like a dream, upon which we're met by our virtual character, by our virtual characters, like our, you know, our loved ones and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
And so my question is, if all of our memories start to fade away after death, and then our virtual character, the people that we dealt with in PMR, the, you know, our loved ones, how can we recognize them if our memories are basically, you know, wiped away at that point?
Okay. Let me answer the questions as you go. I know there's probably more than one here since T said this was a series. Your memory begins to fade from the details of the life that you just led. Okay. And it's not that they fade in an instant. It's not they just suddenly disappear. They just slowly start to go away. You're no longer connected to that world. You're no longer connected to that reality. So it's just like the dream you're no longer connected to after you wake up. You have that dream and you wake up, you're no longer connected to it. And when that connection's broken, it begins to fade. Well, this is the same way. You're no longer connected to that virtual reality that you were in, and that connection begins to fade. That doesn't mean that, you know, it's all suddenly gone. You do have still the thoughts of where am I? What's going on here? You know, what's going to happen next? And usually those sorts of things start to develop fear. People are insecure about the unknown. So here they are, you know, they're in a different place, a different reality frame. They're not quite sure what's going on. They don't know whether it's a dream or not, but they can remember enough that, oh yeah, I was in a hospital bed. I was in a terrible accident, da 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 da. And they might have some idea, oh well, maybe, you know, I'm not in that reality anymore. They kind of get that idea. Things are fading out on them. But as that anxiety starts to develop about what's going to happen next, that uncertainty that creates the anxiety, that's when it's typical for relatives or other people or some other entity to come up and say, oh, hi, glad you're here. You know, we've been waiting for you, and shake hands and hugs and all that. And what that's meant to do is put the person at ease, make them feel more relaxed. Oh, it's okay. All right, this is going to be all right. And it's a game, if you will, that's played to help eliminate or reduce the anxiety that develops because of the unknown and the uncertainty of what's going on. That's the whole thing. So you are going to have that awareness of who your relatives were. Oh, that's, you know, that's my Uncle Fred. Yeah, he passed away, you know, 5 years ago. He was my favorite uncle. You're going to have that because the system's going to give you that connection, because that connection is important, because that's the connection that's going to help you relax and go on to the next step. It's going to help nip in the bud that anxiety that's building once you realize that you're, you know, no longer in Kansas, that you are in a different reality frame. So those connections are going to still be there because they're being used. So it's just like when you get into a dream, the larger system will often just give you a scenario. Suddenly you are, you know, in this situation where a choice is required of you, where you have to make a decision what to do. Well, you're just given that scenario. Well, here, as you wake up, your memory is fading because you're no longer connected there, and you're given the scenario where here are your relatives, here are your friends, here's your best pal that was in a car accident and died a year ago. Those kinds of associations are brought up, and that's basically given to you. Remember, this is all virtual reality. It's all data stream. So the system just puts those relatives in your data stream, if you will, so that now there they are, and you make that connection. It's part of the way that people need to get rid of the anxiety that's building because of the change in the transition process. So it's just a given. It's just part of the new data stream in the new reality is what you're getting. It's another virtual reality. See, it's not like you're going from this physical virtual reality to the real, you know, to the real reality. It's like, well, when you die, you wake up in the real reality. No, you wake up in another virtual reality. You see? So you're getting another data stream. It's a different data stream now. Your consciousness. Consciousness is aware of the data that it gets. That's all it's aware of. So consciousness gets the data. Now you're getting The data stream from the old reality is disappearing. The data stream from the new reality is starting to take over. And the first thing you get in that new reality is something that makes you relax and take it easy and not feel so frightened about what you don't know. So that's why. It's just that becomes part of your new data stream. And in the process of doing this, you're also changing from the free will awareness unit, you know, the thing that was connected to the avatar, back to the individuated unit of consciousness, which is the thing that integrates all of your experiences into one thing. So you're making that transition as well. And as you go through this transition process, you come in as from the perspective of the free will awareness unit that had just died. You go out of this transition process as the individuated unit of consciousness that is the collector of all the consciousness. So that's another transition that's going on, as well as the transition between the realities. You get also the transition between free will awareness units and individuated units of consciousness, all taking place at the same time. So when you get when you start deciding what to do next, that decision doesn't come from the free will awareness unit. That's done now. That's gone too. That what am I going to do next? What's my next incarnation going to be? When you start thinking about that, now you are operating as the individuated unit of consciousness. You see, that old free will awareness unit that was attached to that specific avatar is also phasing out. Basically, you can say all those, the partition that separated that off from the individuated units of consciousness is being taken down. So you end up in then just the individuated unit of consciousness. So we have all those things going on kind of together there.
So the afterlife, you're still your individuated unit of, you're still your yourself, like your so upon leaving, you're still sort of like who you are in this reality when you...
Yeah, you're still connected, right. Right in the instant, right after you die and you disconnect from that reality, your awareness, what you're thinking, the way you feel about things, it's still probably, you know, 95% your free will awareness unit, because, you know, you don't have a major break in your sense of reality and who you are. So that's what you were just before death. That's what you are now. And that's where the anxiety starts, is from that viewpoint. And the transition process is to take that viewpoint and shift it over to another viewpoint, which is the viewpoint of the individuated unit of consciousness that's interested in the next incarnation and what it is, the whole, all of you, all of your experiences, you know, that have all come together to make you what you are now as an individuated unit of consciousness. You know, we take that whole viewpoint. And now what do we want to do next? You see, so that, yes, you're making that kind of a transition from one to another, but transitions have to be smooth. Otherwise, if it was a sudden break, then that would be more anxiety. That would be more fear. That would be more, oh my God, what's going on? You know, suddenly in an instant, you know, everything's different, would scare people. So it's a smooth transition from one to the other that you hardly notice. As you go, it's that kind of thing.
And so when you make the full transition and you're the individuated unit of consciousness, is that the point? Is that where you start planning? Like,
yes.
Can you make decisions still? Like, are you?
Oh yeah, sure. You're thinking. You have. You're aware, and you're making decisions. You're planning. But now you are the individuated unit of consciousness at that point. Not you, the free will awareness unit. See, the you has changed.
Now, how would I identify myself? Well, I would
just the same way you do now. It's just that you have a different background. You're kind of different, but you don't notice that difference. You still feel like you through the whole thing. There's no one time when you feel like, oh, I just changed from one you to another. You know, you're basically have always been that individuated unit of consciousness. You've just been a piece of it. And now you kind of reintegrate with the whole, but it's a very smooth transition. So you don't notice it, but you see things from a different perspective. The perspective you had here as a free will awareness unit was the perspective of the avatar. Okay. And then when you, you know, when that avatar is not connected to you anymore, now you start to see it from the perspective of the individuated unit of consciousness. But as far as you're concerned, it's all still the same you. It's just that your perspective is changing. You don't notice any change in you. You're always just you, but your perspective changes as you move from reality to reality.
Right. All right. And then, so I guess that would probably knock out my third question. So I guess my only next addition to that was that I was going to say that, is there an exception to the rules when it comes to, for example, reincarnation? You know, like, so for instance, I remember you saying in one of your previous interviews and some of the lectures that you give, you were saying that we start off with a clean slate with absolutely no memories. So we start again fresh with a new virtual body. Is there an exception with, like, so for instance, like, let's say that I was a very evolved consciousness and I kind of knew the process and I knew how I wanted to plan the next time coming around or whatever. And so is there a way that I could retain some of myself? Like, could I come back as me again if I just say, okay, I just want to keep that. I don't want to kind of like, I don't want to be, you know, Jim, a farmer, you know, but the next time I want to kind of continue on what I was doing here again. Is there a way that I could retain myself and say, okay, I'm choosing to just be me again, you know, and kind of continue that route? Because, you know, sometimes they say, like, people, you know, like, you know, and Stevens was talking about people coming back and they already knew that their past life so vividly. So if our memories are then, we start with absolutely no memories, how are they exception to the rule? How are they remembering all of these, you know, very detailed stuff out their past life, you know, like even down to like their name, the number, the type of plane they flew, their ID numbers and all that type of stuff. How are they remembering? Is there a way that we could continue on to who we were already?
I got that. There are exceptions. Yes, there are exceptions to that rule, but the exceptions are, they're a little different. It's not exactly as you think. It's not that those people just somehow have retained the information. It's more that those people who have this detailed memory of a past life, that they're given that information. Okay, it's not so much that they retain it as it is that they're given that information. There's a little difference there. But that is an exception, but it's not really that they haven't changed, that they are still the same being. If you're thinking about, you know, you'd like to maintain the same personality with the same memory, that's not going to happen. But sometimes it may be that for a special purpose, special reason, you will be given very specific memories. And you will even be prompted to talk about those memories. And to, you know, and the people around you will be prompted to write it down or check it out and see whether that date is real or not. Well, that's another way that the system kind of gives us all wake-up calls, by producing these sorts of kind of paranormal effects, where why does an 8-year-old child know the serial number on his plane or something like that that he talks about that he was shot down in, right? That's one of the more famous cases where the little boy knew that he was shot down in an aircraft, and I don't remember, World War I, I think, or maybe two. But anyhow, the exceptions are produced on purpose, not because the entity somehow has figured out how to retain, you know, his old personality. You don't want that old personality. I know a lot of people think, well, yes, I do. You know, I want to keep being me. But you really don't want that old personality, because that old personality comes with very specific fears, beliefs, other things that you're trying to get rid of. You don't want to start with baggage. You want to start without any of that baggage. You want to start basically over, so that if you've painted yourself into some sort of corner because you let's say your intellect, like we talked about it with the first question, or not the first, but the second question, if your intellect has always painted you in a corner because it's too judging and too controlling, well, you don't want to come back with a judging, controlling, you know, left brain attitude again, because that got in your way before. You want to be different. You always want to have new and different experiences, because there's more to learn in diversity than there is to learn in sameness. Sameness is a...
So I won't have the same connection of, you know, like for the transition before I attach to the, before I put my card in the slot and attach to the new biology, you were saying that there was a sense that I had of myself, you know, like I can still think and talk. So is that the same self that would be just in the new biology?
Yes, that's the same. That's the same self. Exactly. It's the same individuated unit of consciousness. That's the self you are. That's the accumulation of all the experience packets that you've had. They're all accumulated. That is your consciousness. That's your fundamental consciousness. Now, it takes just a piece of itself, and that's what it then attaches to the new biology, as you say. That's what attaches to the new avatar. Okay, that's what it logs into the virtual reality, our physical, our PMR virtual reality. It logs in with a piece of itself to play that game. And when it does that, all of its past wisdom, all of its past knowledge and understanding, all of its quality, let's put it that way, all of its quality goes in to that new avatar, is a part of that new avatar. So all the quality you keep. That you never lose. So when that new, when that consciousness in that new avatar, it starts with all the quality that it ended with last time. And it's not just its quality, but the quality of the whole, of all the lifetimes, all of that quality added together, all of the lessons added together, that's what it starts with the next avatar. You see, so nothing's lost. What you don't come in with is the individual intellectual experiences. You don't come in with all the memory. See, all the intellectual stuff is gone. What you have is the being level stuff. The stuff that you were, you are again. The stuff that you thought about in your intellect, you're not that again. So it's your intellect that basically gets wiped as far as coming into a new avatar. So you start from scratch that way. You get to make all new choices. All your choices that you get in the new avatar are new choices. And you get to express, you express your being level. Yeah, that, and those choices are from your individuated unit of consciousness. That's you. But
does the individuated unit of consciousness have any being intelligence? You know, like I understand what you're saying when you're saying, like, we disconnect all of our intellect intelligence. So basically, you know, everything I learned, you know, intellectual wise, but does the quality of the consciousness, is that its own personal sort of intellect? Does it, like when we
improve? Yeah, it can think. Yeah. The quality of consciousness, it can think from the being level. You have cognitive function at the being level. Yes, it is an aware, cognitive, communicative consciousness. There's all the attributes of consciousness, but what the part of it that it's going to attach to a new avatar just represents its quality, not its facts. So the fact that you knew how to do calculus in the last life doesn't mean that when you're born that you're going to still know how to do calculus. You're going to have to learn that again. You see, that's part of your intellectual stuff. But the fact that you learned how to get rid of fear, well, when you come in, you will have that quality of not having that fear, because you overcame that fear. So you see, the quality travels with you, but the facts of your last existence don't.
So I would be able to probably, if calculus was, like, let's say, a passion of mine or something, even though I don't have all of my intellectual learnings from it, then maybe when I come back, I'll have some type of attraction to it and pick it up easily. And
yes, you might pick it up. Exactly. You may pick it up very easily because you learned the attitude that you have to approach calculus with. See, calculus is a lot like meditation in that way. You know, like the second question, you know, how do I get the point consciousness? Doing math often has to do with your attitude, with the way you approach it. It's not, you know, it's much easier if you approach it properly than it is if you don't. It's the same thing. Fear gets in the way. Your need to control gets in the way. And yes, once you overcome those kinds of things and you get really good at it, the next time getting good at it again is easier because you've learned the approaches. You've gotten rid of the fears. Yes, and that goes with all sorts of skills. You know, if you were a very excellent musician, you probably would tend to move toward music, and it would be easier for you to pick up an instrument and learn how to play it because you have the right attitudes, you have the right sense of approach of how you do that, the sense of practice. If you don't have any of that sense, then you get easily frustrated, you see, because you have expectations. Well, I've been trying to play this instrument for a week and I can't play anything with it. You see, you have these expectations and that frustrates you. So if you've overcome that kind of attitude, then you don't have that. You can approach your practice and know that you are going someplace and you're making progress, even if you can't play a tune yet. So you're just better at it. It's an attitudinal thing, not an information thing, not a left brain, not a fact thing. It's a inner quality thing that makes things easier. Yes, and that you do bring with you.
Oh, I see. So patterns of habit, we bring that to, like, our patterns and stuff. That's cool.
Yes.
All right. Thank you so much. That helped out a lot. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Yeah, they were great questions, Lawrence. Thanks for asking them. We're going to have to move on, Tom, because we've got a lot to get through, and I think we're going to be slipping behind here if we're not careful. So the next one is from Sophia on programming quantum computers. Tom, I recently heard about quantum computers for the first time and how they will theoretically process information in multiple dimensions using ones and zeros simultaneously along with every number in between. I didn't even know there were numbers in between. Okay. what do I know? This computer has been sold to NASA recently in a rudimentary form in order to find information in different dimensions, solve large problems humanity faces, and possibly alter the course of our current reality. However, no one knows how to program this computer, control its output, and gather meaningful information. My theory on how this will be done, since a quantum computer is accessing data in NPMR, is that whatever programs, measures, and directs the output is also going to need to be in NPMR. Since the human brain can access NPMR, non-physical material reality, will we end up using our minds to program this quantum computer? So what do you foresee as a tool to use this type of computer successfully? And if there's anything else you know about quantum computers in general, please could you share it with us?
Okay. First of all, the quantum computer is not going to be accessing data out of, NPMR. It's not the way it works. It's a PMR machine, and it just deals with things. The problem that she's talking about is that quantum computing, though it is a real thing in the sense that we have people now selling quantum computers, you know, there are people making them for sale and people using them, it's still mostly theory, and the application is just very small still. And yes, there's a lot of things they don't know. There's a lot of problems with that. And we don't even know, although we tend to be very optimistic about our technology, but there really is no way to know whether this quantum computing will ever materialize its full potential. It may be that there are issues that don't allow us to tap its full potential, that it can compute much faster, many different lines of computing, if you will, because it uses, and what she's confusing here is that it's not that there's a whole lot of numbers between one and zero, Keith. It's that it takes a superposition of one and zero. So you have one and zero plus all of the in-between states that are superpositions of one and zero. And that's just a quantum mechanical thing. They basically come out in the math as cross terms, that you have ones and zeros, and then you have other terms that it's not numbers in between one and zero, but rather states, okay? Just states of existence between ones and zeros that are superpositions of those two things in various amounts. So it's just, in theory, it will be a very, very powerful computer. But turning that theory into practice is a very difficult thing to do. And an optimist would say, oh, we'll work all those details out. A pessimist would say, we may not ever work those details out. And the truth is probably someplace in between. We'll work some of those details out and we'll make something out of those quantum computers, but will they actually end up being the thing that we hope they will be, which is something that is, you know, many thousands of times more powerful than what we have now? Maybe, maybe not. We haven't gotten there yet. The proof of that is still in the future. So quantum computing is good theory. It's a good idea, whether it can be controlled, whether it can be sufficiently, whether it can be programmed sufficiently, whether we can make use of all that potential is yet to be known. So there's a lot of excitement about it. But most of that excitement is about the theoretical possibilities, not about what it actually can do now or what we will ever be able to actually do with it. We don't know that. So it's one of those things that holds great promise if we can get all of its potential out to be usable, but whether we can or not is just not clear. So I'd say stay tuned. You probably read an article that was very positive about all the magnificent things we're going to do in just a few years, and that may or may not come to pass. So kind of look at it as a promising new technology with tremendous potential, and we'll see how much of that potential we can actually realize as a real operational thing here in this reality. So I'd caution on the getting too overexcited about the things that quantum computers are going to do in the future. They may do those things, or they may not. We just don't know yet.
And of course, with great power comes great responsibility, right?
Hey, always.
Great quote. Okay. talking of great, Pally has several great questions for you today. Let's see which one he's going to ask first. Pally, it's all yours.
Thank you very much. Hi, Tom. A few months ago, I've asked you a question here about the possibility to change our motivation for the intent. And I later on discovered that maybe one aspect of this question was still open for me. So I tried to address it here. If I'm in a situation where I see that my intent is motivated by fear, how can I change that motivation and intent? Because if I change it because I see it is fear-based, this actual second intent is again motivated by fear. So if I see this progression, I'm feeling increasingly anxious and stressed out. So it's hard to see any loving side of things at that situation. Mm-hmm. Would you like to address it here?
Sure. Yeah, well, let's do them one at a time, one piece at a time. Yep. So what your question is that when you realize that you're being motivated, that your intent is fear motivated, just that realization creates some fear and some stress, because now there you see it and you don't really know how to fix it. And now you've got a new fear. And now the new fear is that you don't know how to fix it and you won't be able to fix it, but you see it and can't do anything about it. And that's frustrating. So you get into that kind of a problem with it. Well, you know, in the book, I describe the growth process as pulling yourself up by your bootstraps, which of course is just a metaphor. And it's like all of growing up is not done through an intellectual process. We don't grow up because we see a path. So, here's the path that I will take to grow up. It just happens. It just happens. You grow up because of all the choices, all the little choices you make along the path. You see, growing up is a process, not something that you can write a prescription for, not something that you can say, well, here are the steps. I'm going to go from a child to an adult, and I've got these 10 steps, And when I'm finished those 10 steps, I'll be an adult. And then you sit down and, you know, map out the 10 steps and try to do them. Well, that's all with your intellect. Growing up doesn't have anything to do with your intellect. Growing up has to do with the choices you make at the being level, you see. So if we try with our left brain to add structure to it, we want to have the, you know, what's the solution to this problem? All right, I see that I'm acting out of fear. That's a problem. Now we want a solution. And we want the solution to be like, you know, a set of logical steps that we take. And if we take all these steps, we're done. But it's not like that. Growing up doesn't have that kind of a logical solution. The pulling yourself up by your bootstraps is just the everyday thousands of choices that you make and the way you feel, the way you choose to feel about things. And the way you change it isn't with a plan so much as it is with an intent to not do that. It's an intent to not feel that way. It's an intent to not let that fear push you into that kind of, you know, behavior. Well, now behavior is out at the doing level. See? Behavior isn't at the being level. Behavior is out at the doing level. So, and our intellect can take the lead here by pointing the direction. That behavior, and the behavior may be a feeling, may not actually be an action. It may be a feeling. That behavior is not healthy. I don't want to do that. And if you have that as a strong intent, not just wishful thinking, but a strong intent, then when you do it, it'll trigger. And you go, oh, there I am again. I'm feeling that way in this situation. And then you'll try to put that aside, just like you put thoughts out of your mind when you meditate. You just put that aside, put that feeling aside and say, I don't want that feeling. And then you go on and then you'll trigger it again. And you'll say, don't want to go there. Don't want that feeling. Don't want to process it that way. Put it aside, you see. And eventually what happens is that feeling will get weaker and weaker and weaker till it disappears. So it's not that you did something particularly clever to make it go away. It's the thousands of little choices that you made to not go there and set it aside that eventually get rid of it. So all growing up is done tiny piece at a time, tiny little individual choices. It's not that you attack the whole problem and then get a big resolution. If you try that, that doesn't work. That's like trying to use your intellect to grow up. It doesn't work. It's just all the little choices you make. So start down at the, you know, down in the weeds, down in the grass level feelings of how you feel. Catch yourself, and you won't always catch yourself. Sometimes you won't catch yourself until you think about it the next day. And you go, oh, I fell in that trap again. And then use your intent to say, I don't want to fall in that trap anymore. Next time I get in that kind of a situation, I'm not going to fall in that trap. And if I do, I'll recognize it right away and I'll put it aside. I'll put that feeling of inadequacy or that feeling of fear, that feeling of control, I'll just put it aside and deal with it some other way. I won't deal with it with that construct. Eventually, if you have the intent to do this and it's a strong, real intent at your being level, that intent will win out. It'll go away. And eventually you just won't feel that way anymore in those situations. And then you will have outgrown it. So that's the thing. The real mechanism that drives your solution here is your intent, not any doing, not any plan, but just your intent to overcome it. If your intent to overcome it is strong and persistent, you will overcome it. Now, some people confuse wishful thinking with a focused intent. You see, there's a difference there. If you say, oh yeah, I shouldn't get angry like that, and you know, I wish I wasn't like that, and it's a wishful intent, and I'm going to try not to do that anymore, but it's not really a commitment at the being level. It's more of a wishing that it wasn't so. Well, the wishing that it wasn't so doesn't carry any power. It's not going to change you any. It's the deep commitment at the being level that I want to change. I don't want to be that way. And that commitment then will change you and you won't be that way. But it's not going to be quick. You'll still make that mistake 100 times, But every time you catch yourself and can set it aside so that you don't continue down that path, you'll find that it will get, you know, that proclivity to make that mistake will get weaker and weaker and weaker until it's gone. And then what you've done is you've just erased a fear, and you don't have that fear anymore. And now it's not that you have successfully suppressed that reaction. It's not about suppressing your fearful reaction. It's about getting rid of it. See? So we don't want to use our intellect to control. Oh, okay, I'm acting that way again. Well, I'll control that. I'll just smile instead, and I won't say any of those mean things I was thinking. Well, now you're using your intellect to force your behavior to be better, but that's not helping you grow up at the being level. You see, if you do that, now you're not going to grow up. You're not going to pull yourself up by your bootstraps because you're approaching it from the wrong direction. It has to be a serious, honest, authentic intent at the being level to change, and you will change.
Thank you, Tom. So if I take it to the example I mentioned where I get stuck at, noticing that my intent is fearful and getting more fear out of it, if I understand it correctly, you would recommend that, okay, I noticed it, and do whatever I can at that situation, and basically say I don't want it to be like this for the next time, and keep that intent, and basically, not worry too much about this one situation, because new situations will arise, and with time and with my intent, if it's really true, it will get lesser and lesser in my life, yes. And it should cease. Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yes. And see, the very first step, which was, okay, you're aware of the problem, and that awareness then creates a new problem. That's basically comes out of your wanting to control, and you know, you want to control the problem, but you get another problem trying to control that problem. You see, that's an unending. That's an unending series. So you don't want to go there. So when you see you have that problem, rather than having the idea that now I have to control it, the idea should be, I accept that. I am that way. Okay, I have this fear reaction. That's me. Own it. And then once you own it, say, I don't want to be that way. And then keep that intent, and it'll go away. But once you own it, then you don't have to be fearful that you're fearful. You see, just own it. Okay, I am fearful in this situation. That's me, but I don't want to be that way. And it's not that I don't want to act that way. I don't want to be that way. And that's a very important differentiation. If you work on I don't want to be that way, you'll end up learning how to suppress bad behavior, which other people will appreciate, but it's not going to take you anywhere further in your evolution. So it's I don't want to be that way. And I need to change me at the being level. And with that intent, you will succeed at it over time. And the first one is the hardest. It'll be easier and easier to succeed once you get the hang of it. But accept it. You see that fear? Say, yep, that's me. But I don't like it. And I want to be different.
Yeah. And when you mention it now, I remember that I have one technique I try to use with my analytical brain, which is to be thankful for noticing it when it arises.
Yes.
With that, I can stop the next generation of fears coming up.
Yes.
Yeah. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Recognizing that you have the fear is usually the hardest step to get to. That's the big one. You know, that's the giant step. After that, it gets easier. Once you recognize it, the rest of it is just persistence at wanting to change yourself. And it always works. You always will change yourself. You know, that's really the easy. It takes some time, but that's the easy part. The hard part is realizing that you have the problem in the first place. That's the hardest step. So you're getting the hard step. And the other step you just have to be persistent with.